Hi, and welcome to CW Talks, the Composites Podcast. I'm Scott Francis, Senior Editor of Composites World. My guest today is John Riando, Director of Business Development at the Rhode Island Commerce. John has spent much of his career specializing in business development in the defense and maritime industries. Today, he'll share insights into how and why Rhode Island companies are leveraging centuries of boat building expertise to expand into numerous composites-related industries. Hi, John, and welcome to CW Talks.
Well, hi, Scott, and thanks for having me.
Rhode Island has a long history of boat building experience. How has that kind of translated over time into expertise in the composites industry?
Well, you're right, Scott. It is an extensive history at that, but I'm going to take it back, you know, as you know, our history as the ocean state and the fact that our cities were established on ports such as Newport, Bristol, Providence. And as shipping was critical to our economic growth and expansion start from the, this goes back to the pre-revolutionary days, construction of vessels of all types, from ferries to transport barges to ocean-going sailing vessels, they really define Rhode Island and its role in U.S. and international commerce. So I'll give you some examples. You know, we had the sloop Katy, which was built in Rhode Island, and eventually was transferred to the U.S. Navy and renamed the sloop Providence. It was given to the U.S. Navy. It's the first official vessel accepted by the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Navy was just coming into its own at that time and really did not know how to procure or where to go and how to start to get a vessel of its own. So accepting this vessel was key. And that was the start in the 1700s. In the 1800s, now steel ships are coming into their own. Steel is another material that came in, was being worked with wood at the same time and eventually came into its own as its own vessel made of steel. And what you're looking at is, you know, the steam engine came about at that time. And in Rhode Island, you had a company that basically started the steam engine. It was called Corliss Steam Engines. They were independent power plants that could be put on land to run a factory or in a vessel such as this to run a steam vessel. So they were steamers. They were ferries. They were warships. And, of course, in the late 1800s, we had Nathaniel Herreshoff and what he was doing for Rhode Island. He was basically a maritime genius. He has over 2,000-plus designs to his credit, and they range from racing and cruising yachts to many small boats, a canoe, for example, and also military vessels. Examples are the J-class boat. The Whirlwind is an example of that back in the 1920s and 30s. On the military side, we had the torpedo boat Stiletto, which was designed specifically for the U.S. Navy. And of course, you know, then we had in the 1851, we had a vessel called the America. And the America went over to England to participate in a race around the Isle of Wight. It won the race, and it was 100 guinea cup was what went along with that cup was 100 guineas. And the America came back to the U.S., winning the cup, hosting the cup. And of course, the New York Yacht Club at the time decided to rename the cup to the America's Cup. Well, the New York Yacht Club held that cup until 1983. So that's pretty significant in its own right. So being able to design vessels, race vessels, win in match races for over, you know, a century is a testament to Rhode Island's capability of manufacturing, shaping wood, and putting out a great product. And of course, then we had the Gilded Age in the 1870s to 1890s. And this age brought about more demand for boats as transportation for pleasure. We now had disposable income. And getting from New York and other locations in that area to Newport, Narragansett Pier. So the capabilities and skills to shape wood, bend steel, were present and are present and continue to allow Rhode Island designers and builders to think the impossible.
So can you speak a little bit in general about some of the more recent trends in the boat building industry and how those might have led to composites expanding into other areas? What are some of the opportunities that arose and how did companies take advantage of it?
So, you know, here again, we had fiberglass, which was the precursor and the start to we'll call where you're blending a textile with a resin, a chemical, and merging the two to create a new product. And so in the 40s, this was coming into its own, but it was very novel, very new. And like anything else, adaptation is key. And it wasn't until 1947, which actually is quite a ways away when you think about it, that the first fiberglass mass-produced boat was produced and established. And that was a small catboat, a sailboat, called the B.B. Swan. And, you know, this kind of new material was lighter. It was novel at the time. It could withstand the elements. It could withstand moisture. It could withstand insects. It didn't have a problem with insects or rot. And as a result, it was a new medium to play with. And playing with this and looking at other exotic materials, you know, these new materials that were coming in beyond that, carbon fiber was really being looked at in the 1970s. Kevlar, similar in the 1970s, you know, this new material coming about. And these new materials were durable. They were lighter weight. They're water resistant, insect resistant. And some of these materials being used outside of boats include race car bodies, architectural features and facades, portable enclosures for the military. Basically, they fold upon themselves, string instruments, and the list goes on and on.
Right. Thinking about the boating industries, and, you know, a lot of that is sort of tied to recreational pastimes. I'm wondering if you have any insights into some of the trends that kind of happen with that, economic trends play into companies kind of switching into other areas or expanding into other areas. Like during soft times, they might explore new markets.
Yeah, and you're correct, Scott. It's in downtimes, you know, in those companies that are able to survive, mm-hmm. because they produce good products and they still have a market share in a, you know, in a certain product line that is selling, which obviously generates revenue, they have to experiment. They have to do research and development. They have to look beyond and say, what's our next customer base? And that holds true to a lot of industries in Rhode Island, in particular manufacturing, and how Rhode Island School of Design got established way back in the 1870s. You know, it was the mill owners needed products to manufacture. And for that to happen, they needed design. They needed designs of all kinds of products so they could manufacture and put it out there. So going back to the boat building industry, they saw that opportunity and they did experiment. And it wasn't easy.
Right.
Because again, acceptance is difficult. You have to sell it. You have to sell this new product as being convenient, and it's pluses and minuses, more pluses than minuses, which is why they experiment with it. But it isn't until they do that and they start off with a small, it could be a small boat, and I mean a dinghy. It could be another product, such as race cars or anything right. along those lines. And so, yeah, it's not uncommon for that kind of ingenuity and research and development to come out of that kind of an environment where you have no alternative. You know you have to round the corner. You don't know what's around the corner, but you got to get there. You got to try. You have to experiment and see as you get there.
Right. With that said, can you speak to some of what Rhode Island companies are doing with composites today? What kind of industries have you noticed that they're creating products for from these materials outside of the boating industry?
Well, again, and they vary, and you're absolutely right. As acceptance becomes broader and more people get to understand the composites and what they can do on their behalf and possibly into their specific component, then industry sectors are accepting and ordering materials and that these materials be used in their products. And I'll give you an example. So we produce in Rhode Island, we have a company called Crawford High Performance Composites. And what they do is they do and work with NASCAR and IndyCar. So they make race bodies. And they've been doing that for a while, but they're also going beyond the body. They're looking at components of the car itself, which is a good thing. They also do rowing shells that are sold worldwide for private clubs and colleges and universities, and they have a high demand for those rowing shells. Other companies are producing carbon fiber parts for the F-22 and the F-35 fighter jets for the U.S. Navy. Architecture, I've recently seen a custom spiral staircase that literally supports itself. There is no center pole. That's the beauty of carbon fiber, the strength, showcasing that it can withstand its own weight. and take weight of users on the product, and yet still adorn the perimeter of that product with nice exotic woods. And I've seen examples of that. You know, when the McLaren company decided to create the most exotic sports car in history, they built the first production car to use a carbon fiber chassis. Very unique in its time. It was the 627 horsepower race car, the F1 LM6.1, which was built for the 24-hour races at Le Mans. When you look at Boeing, the Boeing 787 contains approximately 77,000 pounds of carbon fiber reinforced polymer, with another 51,000 pounds of carbon fiber in that plane. That's absolutely unheard of, and yet it's being done. So these exotic materials are being accepted, not just by conventional aircraft, but by also other, as we pointed out, fighter jets, which have tolerances and speeds on them that are just unbelievable.
So I read a piece that you'd written where you focused on a couple of Rhode Island-based companies, Clear Carbon and Components, otherwise known as C3, and Goats Composites. I was wondering if we might examine those two companies as a little bit of an example of this shift that we've kind of been talking about. Can you tell us a bit about what these two companies are doing, particularly how and why they expanded from boat building to other areas?
Good question, Scott. And here again, I'll use the examples, as you pointed out, Clear Carbon and Components. So Matt Dunham, who is the founder of the company, himself, in his youth, a boat builder, learned the skills for setting fiberglass and resin in a mold to build a boat. And clearly, when he created his own company, he wanted to experiment his own way and do things his own way. And effectively has done that with all types of different components and getting into carbon fiber, Kevlar, other exotic materials. And examples of that are, he's doing, on behalf of the military, he does an enclosure that is portable and foldable. And this enclosure can literally, you pull it apart and it's a 20-foot box. By which it could be used for housing, it could be used for a military command post, et cetera. That's carbon fiber. He also does unique vessels. He'll do tow vessels for the U.S. Navy, effectively targets. He does undersea unmanned vehicles. So he's doing some pretty unique things, and yet he's also doing something that evolved through a friend. He experimented, did a lot of prototype development with it, a lot of options to consider, and now he's one of the premier string instrument manufacturers in the country. These are violins, they're cellos, they're violas along those lines, and totally different customer base from the U.S. military.
Right.
He also does a portable matting system, again, all carbon fiber, that you literally unroll. Picture this thing at about 10 feet wide that unrolls and lays over wet ground, so muddy ground, so that vehicles can transit over it. And you just roll it back up and you take it with you. That's directly for the military and other users that want to get over this kind of a terrain. Oh, and another for Clear Carbon, he does some very exotic furniture, very high end, again, very durable, could withstand, the elements. It can accept color because the color is infused into the product itself. Very unique builder, designer of various composite components. Getz Composite is the other company you talked about. And, Eric Getz has been around since the 70s playing with this stuff. And it wasn't until 1984 that he built, on behalf of a German customer, a custom carbon fiber racing yacht called the Freyrs 54. And that goes back to 84. So that was 36 years ago. So at that time, that was novel. That was a novel boat, a novel vessel, and it caught a lot of attention. And again, it was lighter, more durable, faster. Here again, when people see that, they want what that is. They want the same materials in their boats. The other part about Getz is he's gotten into the architectural field. And very unique pieces. For example, if you ever go to Universal Studios in Orlando, he has worked extensively with the wizarding world of Harry Potter in doing very unique pieces that are on the exterior of buildings as you go around through the display. He did a piece for the Miami Design District called the Fly's Eye Dome. Very difficult to describe through this kind of a venue, but if you ever Google that, it's absolutely incredible. And again, it's an architectural piece designed by an artist and looking for somebody that could build his design. And it's Rhode Island that stands out. It's just not Eric Getz. It's other companies like Eric who have that capability, have been able to work with these kind of exotic materials and resins and are able to produce. And that's the uniqueness of Rhode Island and why people look them up and want to see their products built from Rhode Island builders.
With all that said, what are your thoughts on the future for both the boat building industry and also for the composites industry? What opportunities are you seeing that are sort of on the rise?
You know, here again, what I'm seeing, and as I do my day-to-day job of going around and working with these companies and the defense industry and manufacturers all over the state, you know, I see the common denominator is the resourcefulness of these industry players to continue to lead the world in new construction techniques. And that ultimately translates into continued awareness of Rhode Island's boat builders and their capabilities. And the word does get out. So I'm high on this. I'm really excited on this because I think customers who have unique products to construct will come to Rhode Island and they see the possibilities. They've seen them physically throughout the world, whether it's architectural pieces, whether it's through airplane parts, whether it's through any type of vessel, string instruments, or even, wind energy systems, the blades. They know what Rhode Island can do, and Rhode Island's name is out there. And so I'm very excited about the industry for our boat building industry, who again, are up to the task of what's next. How are they going to do the next product? What are their materials that they're playing with today that could be utilized for racing yachts, military vessels, whatever that may be, and other unique products? Yeah, so I'm very excited because as we've seen throughout our history, and this goes back centuries, we're able to adapt, we're able to adjust, and we're able to put out very good products for our customers.
So I'm going to shift a little bit here to some of the other possibilities that composites sort of allow for. I want to sort of talk a little bit about sustainability. There's a couple of areas I want to focus on. One is a couple of years ago, the Rhode Island Marine Trades Association, I believe it's known as RIMTA, launched a recycling initiative called the Rhode Island Fiberglass Vessel Recycling Project, where fiberglass boat hulls were dismantled and reprocessed into cement. I'm wondering if you have any insights into that program, sort of is that still going on, and other maybe sustainability efforts that are happening sort of within these composites-related industries.
I am familiar with the RIMTA project, and you're right. As a native Rhode Islander and a boater, I own several boats myself, from a dinghy to a small sailboat to a powerboat. And, you know, if you go along the coastal communities, whether you're in the bay itself or outside of the bay, and you go down to the beach communities, it's not uncommon to see a boat or two in the backyard. And again, talking about these, fiberglass, talking about carbon fiber, they're durable. They don't corrode. They don't fall apart. And as a result, it creates another problem on the recycling part, on the end use, when the boat is, you don't want the boat and it would cost too much money to rehab. So what do you do with it? You trash it. And most people leave it in their backyard until it literally falls off the trailer because the trailer will rust off first and the boat is still sitting on top of it. And it's a real problem. And you're right. So looking at how do you recycle this fiberglass material? Oh, and the resins, the chemical resins that went in there. And what do you do with it? And how is it going to be used? So, yes, the recycling program, and there have been, this attempt by RIMTA, which is partly also with the University of Rhode Island, is a good move towards, dealing with a real problem, which is, you know, these used boats that are in the backyards doing nothing, and you've got to get rid of them. And yet, in a way that hopefully the materials can be reutilized.
Right.
So in some cases, it's called shredding. They basically are shredding the boats in a way that at least you have a smaller component of the boat. And other times, you can take those small components and you can work them again into another product. And I know for a fact that the U.S. Department of Transportation is looking at that and working with asphalt and seeing what is the blend. Is there an opportunity here to blend this residual fiberglass and resin product into asphalt and therefore make roadways out of it? You know, that's just one example. So, yeah, there needs to be more work done on that. And the incentive has to be there. And so that's a market issue that I think has to be dealt with. But it is being dealt with on the, you know, on the material side, since we do understand these materials. And that is to understand how they could be reused, recycled, and used into other products for the foreseeable future.
Right. Yeah, I feel like I've seen some stuff on wind blades as well, where they're looking at ways to recycle into cement and that sort of thing as well, which kind of leads into wind energy. What would you say you're noticing for Rhode Island in that market?
Well, you know, back in 2016, November, December of 2016, Rhode Island activated and it went online, the Block Island Wind Power Project, the first such project offshore wind energy system ever constructed on the East Coast. A pilot project caught a lot of attention, a lot of eyes looking at it. And to quote then Secretary of Interior, Mr. Salazar, he was saying, if you want to know how to do it, go to Rhode Island. Quote, they figured it out. And we did. We spent a lot of energy, a lot of time in the offshore wind energy, hence giving us this first project back in 2016. We've become industry leaders in that respect, how to do it, how to understand not only the environmental impacts and how to work with the, you know, the users and the uses of this open water environment, the oceans.
Right.
So these wind systems, and when you look at them, you know, for what they are, mostly they're steel towers. The blades are made of fiberglass and other exotic materials. So could carbon fiber expand beyond the blades? Well, maybe with more research and development, prototype demonstrations, we could see changes in potentially in the construction materials. I'll give you a stat. TPI Composites, which has an office and a facility here in Warren, Rhode Island, and where they produce all of the prototype blades and design and set the molds for ultimately the blades that will be constructed by the company in its many facilities worldwide, such as Iowa, Mexico, China. Between 2001 and 2019, TPI manufactured over 51,000 blades for the offshore, for the wind energy industry sector.
Wow.
Not surprisingly, China is probably one of the most, or they are the highest user of onshore wind energy systems. U.S. right behind them. Germany is another country that has gone that route, and 80 other countries have installed wind energy systems in their countries of greater than 1 megawatt. So clearly the industry is being accepted. It understands what it needs to do. And the efficiencies of purchasing and meeting their life expectancy of 20, 25, 30 years seem to be being met. As we know, the Europeans have been out doing this stuff for that kind of length of time. So yeah, we're very excited about the offshore wind industry. We're excited because, you know, recently we just had Ørsted Wind, which is a Danish company, come into the state, and they decided that Providence, Rhode Island, was where they were going to set up their innovation hub. And that was just announced a couple of weeks ago. And that was important. And it was very impressive because they could have done that anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, but they opted for Providence. Why? They saw where we are, where Rhode Island is at. They knew that we have experience. They know that we have been doing this for a while. Yes, we're in our infancy, but we're out there meeting the challenge. We have the capabilities with the help of the Graduate School of Oceanography at URI to understand what's happening in the water column in situ at the bottom. They understand what's happening above the water column and into, you know, the stratosphere. So I think, you know, we're very excited about the offshore wind industry in Rhode Island and for our neighboring states, as we have the resources with ports. We have it's physical assets that we have, but we also have the ability through our engineers and scientists, both in the private sector and also at the higher education level, such as the University of Rhode Island College of Engineering and Graduate School of Oceanography. So we can continue to show the rest of our states, the rest of our fellow states, what we're doing and how to do it.
That's great. Well, John, I want to thank you very much for your time today. It's exciting to talk to someone who's so excited about these materials and everything that they offer, and it's exciting to hear about the ways Rhode Island is doing some really great things.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate that. And I think you're right. I do get excited about it because doing this for a while, seeing where we are at, there's hope, a lot of hope. There's a lot of opportunity, and it's a path we need to go down. We will go down, and we are showing the rest of our fellow states that Rhode Island is where it's happening. Come to Rhode Island if you want to learn about these things.
Well, thanks again for your time today, John. We really appreciate it. Also, thanks to our listeners for tuning in to CW Talks, the Composites Podcast. If you want to hear more CW Talks, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Google Play. You can also find a link to our podcast at compositesworld.com/podcast. That's all for now, and we'll catch you next time.